You are listening to The News Project for the week of November 18th, 2019. Brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's podcast brings you these stories. The Manchester Select Board accepts the rail trail scoping study. Vermont's Climate Solution Caucus meets in Arlington. Weston's Farrar Mansour House and Museum is definitely worth a visit. BBA notches a second state football title. And in part two, investment advisor Todd Walker continues on the essentials of investing.
The Manchester Select Board formally accepted a scoping study on a proposed 3-mile-long recreational pathway running from Riley Rink to the North Road at its regular meeting on Tuesday, November 12th, setting the stage for further discussions and a probable public vote during March Town Meeting, which will determine whether or not to actually go forward with and build the long-delayed biking, jogging, and walking trail. The acceptance of the study was basically a procedural formality and will not by itself determine whether or not the trail would be built. The scoping study, designed to flesh out what features should be in place, such as the type of trail service that should be used, was the subject of several earlier meetings at the Park House at the town's Recreation Park, where the project was dissected and gave members of the public opportunities to weigh in. Several of the immediate neighboring landowners showed up for them and were often leery about the prospects of turning a former and long unused railroad line into a walking or biking trail that would bring more people alongside their backyards. Dan Peck of VHB, a consulting and civil engineering firm which has been working with the town to develop a design for the possible trail, reviewed the background of the project with the Select Board on Tuesday night. It began almost 20 years ago with a feasibility study that identified the corridor as a possible location for the trail, and through the purchase of the former rail line that formed part of the proposed trail by a group of local citizens. He then walked the Select Board and the audience through the study the consultants have been working on. The route crosses three streams that will require small bridges to be constructed for the pathway, which would be surfaced and screened off in places. Cost estimates for the trail have come in at around $1.5 million, with 80% of that coming from state or federal funds, which have yet to be secured. The remaining 20% would require local funding, which would likely be a combination of public revenues and private donations. Afterwards, Robin Verner, one of the group of residents who have been advocating for the rail trail for several years, gave us his takeaway from the meeting.
Yes, the scoping study has taken quite a few months, and they've examined all kinds of things. It's been open to the public to make comments, suggestions, and so forth, and it's been wrapped up. What kind of a surface is going to be on the trail. They've selected a sheer pack surface. What kind of bridges we're going to use or they are going to use has been selected. They're going to be what's called a girder bridge. I haven't decided exactly what kind of a surface will be on it. So those are all positive things. The study was completed, and the people that VHB that did the study concluded that there is a lot of support in the town for this project, and it's moving forward. Well, the trail can be used now, but of course it's not. You would walk it at your own risk because it's still privately owned. But I believe the format would be to do this, to do the trail in two or three sections. So years ago, it wasn't uncommon to get a larger amount of money to complete the project in one shot. But the way it's being done now is they make an agreement that you're going to get the money, but they give it to you in two or three installments. So you do part of the project and one of the bridges, and part of the project and so forth. So it's still going to be probably 2 or 3 years, I would assume.
The next step is likely to be a public vote at town meeting. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Members of the state's Legislative Climate Change Caucus gathered at the East Arlington Federated Church on Wednesday, November 13th, for a presentation and discussion of some ideas and legislation they hope to advance in the coming session scheduled to begin in early January. They also got to hear from members of the audience, who filled most of the pews in the church, who offered up a few thoughts and ideas of their own on a complex issue that defies easy solution and calls for some adjustments and what some would see as sacrifice to meet longer-term goals. Representative Sarah Copeland-Hanzas, who is a co-chair of the Climate Caucus, was the lead presenter of a legislative proposal the caucus has been developing to curb climate change pollution in Vermont. Other panel and caucus members included State Senator Brian Campion of Bennington County, Representative David Durfee of Shasbury, and Representative Kathleen James, who represents Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and most of Sunderland. They and their fellow caucus members are hoping to obtain passage of a bill known as the Global Warming Solutions Act that would cut polluting emissions, make emissions goals requirements, and foster innovation. There are four main pillars around which they built the proposed statute, Copeland-Hanzas said: accountability, transportation, thermal efficiency, and building more renewable in-state electrification.
It is a strategy to focus every single state agency on cutting pollution. It's going to be important because we need to take our aspirations that we've been missing, that we've not been reaching, and we need to put them into statute as requirements so that everybody has to come to the table and help figure out how to make this happen. And this accountability measure is really foundational to many of the other things that will also need to come in future years. So the accountability in the Global Warming Solutions Act is going to be key to future work that we do.
After each of the panelists spoke to the value of the proposed legislation, it was the turn of the audience to weigh in, and they followed the panelists with a series of questions and suggestions.
Electric industry in Vermont is not in as good shape relative to carbon as you might think, because all these solutions, and you hit on it, electric vehicles and electric heating, rely on more electricity. And we've been fortunate, or the utilities have been fortunate, that the electric load has been going down. And it's been easy for them to meet their goals. But when it begins going up, it's going to be a lot harder. But my question to you is, has the caucus done any thinking? This goes to the ladies' discussion on costs. Have you done any thinking on the costs of not doing not addressing climate change?
And I don't pretend for a moment that just because Vermont turns the corner and starts reducing its greenhouse gas emissions that that's somehow going to save the world. But what I know it will do is it will give other states who have larger emissions problems than we do an idea of how to do it. And that's the reason why Vermont can and should lead on reducing our greenhouse gas.
About all of the things that we can do, because the truth of the matter is, a state that is already 94% clean energy, that only has a population of 600,000 people, cannot contribute to decarbonization globally unless you think big and think with imagination and contribute to what's going on elsewhere. And if you do those things, you can have a real impact. But if you don't, what you're going to get is pushback from people saying, I'm struggling with the bills, why are you asking me for more stuff?
And I'm not discounting this climate issue, right? It's something we need to work on. But the question is, where does it fit in the chain of priorities? Because right now, I'm going to assure you, here in southwestern Vermont, we have a lot of priority. We have a lot more serious issues than whether or not we should all go out and buy an electric car. That's not the issue right now. The issue is whether or not we're going to have a school. We're going to have some of the major employers here. And I'm not sure you're familiar with Bennington. We just lost Energizer, and just 2 years ago we lost Fasan. Why? They can't get employed.
If I may just mention one thing to John's point. I think he raised a lot of good points. I do think that there is a connection between bringing young people here and renewable energy. I even see it at Bennington College. I see young people making their decisions around where they want to go to college, what food they want to buy, where they shop. A lot of those now are connected to renewable energy and agriculture and local. So I do think the more we do, we are going to continue to see an increase in terms of population. I also want to mention, we have started a little bit in this state to see people leave other states and come to the state of Vermont because they live in coastal areas that they feel are going to be or have already experienced, you know, severe damage. So the population issue, I just want to mention that as well.
We talked with Edward Cameron, a climate change specialist who worked on the Paris Climate Accords, afterwards.
The first thing I would say is that I think it's an excellent initiative by the caucus. I think they're showing real leadership, which the state needs, and I think they're showing a real willingness to consult with local populations, not just listening to those who are supportive of climate leadership, but looking and listening to people who have some genuine concerns and some real skepticism. So I thought that the mere convening of the event was a success. I think they're also looking for the most part at the areas of the economy that need to be decarbonized. They're looking at transport, of course, they're looking at electrification, they're looking at heating. I did think, echoing some of the comments from the floor, that agriculture as a sector is vital, not only because of its emissions, but because of its capacity to enhance resilience and generate local livelihoods, and also enable us as consumers to reduce our own emissions footprint. So I think the lack of agriculture as part of the sectors they're looking at the moment is a concern. I would also say that the strategy development at the moment is focused too narrowly on emissions reductions and doesn't look enough at building societal and ecosystem resilience. And my own comment from the floor is that as we build a low carbon and climate resilient economy, we actually help to address some of the other problems that the state has. We help to create jobs, we drive economic development, we help to retain and attract young people to the state. And so I really think that the caucus, as it moves forward, needs to do more to stress the opportunities that we will benefit from if we do seize this moment, as opposed to always using the language of emergency.
We also had a chance to talk to some of the panelists about their reactions to the forum and what they were taking away from it.
This issue really seriously, and it's a complicated issue. And I think what resonated with me the most is, the turnout was huge. And again, people are concerned. But we also have to find ways to deal with this so it isn't, you know, a huge financial burden on the backs of Vermonters. So how can we do this in a way, again, that all of a sudden, you know, people's costs are going up so high that it you know, certain things become prohibitive and they decide, you know, I can't afford Vermont anymore. And I think we can do that. I think there's a balance there, and I think we just have to figure that out. So again, it's a renewable energy economy. We're dealing with a huge problem, but it works for everybody and people aren't left behind. And I thought the woman's comment about electric vehicles, I mean, they are very expensive. Can we do more? I mean, we did a little bit in the legislature this year to bring down the cost for moderate income Vermonters. And there is indeed a used market starting, but we need to do more. We heard that tonight, and I thought that was a really important takeaway.
So, you know, what I heard from the audience tonight was a lot of people who have begun to use some of these new technologies and renewable energy technologies and are feeling really comfortable with them. And I think it's discussions like this that will allow us to begin to share ideas with our neighbors. So if I'm not sure that I could drive an electric vehicle because I live, you know, on a hill someplace far out of town, maybe I can have a conversation with my neighbor who's been driving an electric vehicle for a number of years and learn a little bit more about how that's worked for them and, you know, what are the tips and tricks.
You know, the caucus has been doing a lot of work on selecting the policy priorities that we want to move forward with in 2020. And so that wasn't my key takeaway tonight. My key takeaway tonight was how vital it is that we be having these conversations with voters, with constituents, with our neighbors. Climate is a complicated issue. It can be a very divisive issue, yet it's a critical issue. And what I took away from tonight, I think, really was the power of community and how important it is that we be willing to listen and that people are willing to show up and agree, disagree, put forward ideas, and try to help us all move forward as a state. Because if we can't do it together, none of the ideas that we have are going to work.
You can watch a recording of the entire 90-minute-long forum on GNET TV. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Bob Brandt, welcome to the Farrar Manser House. Let me give you a little background, and then we'll show you some of the things that we have here. This was not the first part of Weston to be settled, but in 1780, a man by the name of Ezekiel Pease came to this location and built the sawmill that stands next to us. He also built a small dwelling. 15 years later, he sold both properties to a retired militia captain from New Hampshire, and in spite of being retired, he was only in his early 20s, who purchased the property and then built this house between 1795 and 1797. He purchased the property, went back to New Hampshire, married his sweetheart, they came over here, settled here by 1797. We have actually some of Polly Farrar's wedding china in this room. This building stayed in the Farrar family until 1857, when it was sold to the Manser family, who had it for three generations. During the Depression, Frank Manser had the house fall into arrears, both with a mortgage and with taxation, and it was evident that he was going to lose the property. But he wished it to become a museum. We had a philanthropist living up the street by the name of Senator Lewis Parkhurst, who intervened. He and his wife paid the taxes, paid the mortgage, and then turned it over to the Weston Community Club to be converted into a museum. So in 1932, this house became a museum. It was substantially restored, and also the word went out to the townspeople, if you had relics from the early 19th century or even the late 18th century, please donate them, and people did. So what you have in this museum, which is somewhat unique, is first of all, as you can probably see from what's around me, things are not behind glass walls or cordoned off, but this is a house as it would have existed in the 1830s. It's not relics that Uncle Louis brought back from Egypt in 1923. This is a house in Weston, Vermont in the 1830s. All right, we've got Polly and Ollie living here. They had 13 children, all of whom lived to maturity, which was pretty unusual in those days. But I guess that wasn't enough for Polly to do, because she remembered that her family in Temple, New Hampshire, ran a tavern. And she said, "Oliver, if you will build me a tavern room, I will open the tavern, and that will help increase our family's fortunes while you are working in the sawmill." So Oliver decided that was a good idea, and he built the tavern room, which we will take a look at next. This is the tavern room that Oliver built for Polly. The house used to end at this wall, but he added this on. You can see the original ceiling beams are in here, and also period furniture. The original six measures, which were the official measures of the town of Weston, and we have other artifacts from that. So Polly opened a tavern. She worked behind the bar. They served food. There was no lodging here, just food and drink. And you can see there were bars, which is where the expression bar comes from. Liquor was kept behind the bars. The bar is open. She would serve from there. But then she made the observation to Oliver that the women are uncomfortable when the men are in the tavern smoking and drinking and behaving grossly as men so often do. And she asked that, "Would you please build me a ladies' parlor across the hall where things can be a little more refined?" And that's where we would like to go next, is show you the ladies' parlor. All right, here we are in the parlor that Oliver built for his wife. And well, I want to call your attention to particularly the wonderful murals on the walls here. They were painted during the Depression by a WPA artist by the name of Leroy Williams, and they depict Weston as it existed in 1830. So here we see the town doctor ringing his bell. If you needed his services, you came out and he would attend to you. And lo and behold, we still have his bell. These pictures show parts of the town that existed up the hill from here. That building was called the Beehive, and it was famous for having a doorway on each of its levels because, as you can see, it was built into the hillside, and it existed until the 1930s when it was dismantled. A quick aside, I want to point out these wooden sliding shutters here. They're called eye-tight shutters, and they're installed in this room because the Masons held their meetings here, which they wanted to keep in secret. So when they would meet here, they would slide these shutters closed. Here we see an example of Noah's Ark architecture, and that was the house of Judge John Wilder. His daughter was the person who married Senator Parkhurst, who made it possible for this building to become a museum, and he was certainly the outstanding citizen of Weston during his time. Here we have a bridge over the West River. The bridge still exists today, but the boys are gone. This last painting depicts what is now the center of Weston Village. This yellow structure that we are looking at here, that's the building we're standing in today. It was always called the Yellow House in those years. This is Old Parish Church, which of course still stands. It's the one functioning church within the village of Weston. This painting depicts it before a clock tower was installed in the 1850s. And I will call your attention to the gentleman here wearing stovepipe tall hats. And this building was a meeting house. It was shared by three denominations, and priority in the church was awarded to the congregation with the most men who had stovepipe hats. So the Methodists kind of won the competition, but there were other denominations who used that building at the time as well. This museum is open on weekends, particularly Saturday afternoons, 1 to 4, through Columbus Day weekend this fall. It will be open for the first Saturday in the month of December when we celebrate what's called Christmas in Weston in the village, and it will reopen in the spring in June when the theater season begins, at which point it will be open Wednesday afternoons, Saturday afternoons, and Sunday afternoons through Columbus Day of 2020.
There was a special buzz, or maybe it was the sound of multiple sirens, that reverberated through Manchester on Friday, November 15th. That was when the newly crowned state football champion Burn Burton Bulldogs took their victory lap through town, escorted by the Manchester police and fire departments. The parade launched from the Manchester Firehouse, where the players were clearly fired up for the parade.
Well, we're like 6 feet taller than normal, so we feel really high off the ground, and also because we won.
Best team in the state, 2 years in a row, let's go!
School headmaster Mark Tashian was along for the ride in the role of head cheerleader.
20 years ago, we restarted the football program. A year ago, we won the D2 championship. And then first year in D1, we win the state championship. It's never been done. It's all because of these guys. Yeah, Bulldogs!
As Headmaster Tashian said, the Bulldog football team made history by being the first team to go from Division II, which they were state champs in last year, to winning it all in their first year as a Division I school, where they were competing against the largest high schools in the state. They finished the season with a 10-1 record, their only loss coming in an earlier season game against St. Johnsbury Academy, which they avenged in grand style by defeating St. Johnsbury in the final state championship game. Afterwards, BBA's athletic director Dave Maselli summed it up.
We are really excited about what our football team was able to accomplish this year. Certainly over the past couple of years, when the excitement that football generated when they brought it back, I'm going to say around 20 years ago, and it was nice to have a couple of those guys on our sidelines last weekend when the boys won the championship, or the team won the championship. The moving from D2 to D1, I think there were a lot of us who weren't sure how we would do. And as the season went on and we started winning this game and then that game and then started like, wow, this could be something really special here. And the, you know, a testament to the coaches, incredible dedication and the hard work of the athletes themselves. And, you know, they had a great game plan. They executed it really well.
The parade continued down Main Street and back to Burn Burton. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Hey folks, it's Todd with GNAT News, and we're back again in studio with Todd Walker. And who are you with, Todd?
Greenvest.
Greenvest. And what do you do?
We do socially and environmentally responsible investing.
Got it. And you may remember from the last segment, he's going to be doing a series of segments with us over the coming year about all things financial. And in the last segment, Todd, what did we deal with?
Well, we talked about investing basics. You know, just getting ready to start investing and to see investing as a disciplined practice and not willy-nilly from stock tips and things like that. Because when you do that, you're not really investing, you're gambling.
And in this segment, what are we going to tackle?
Well, we're going to move on. We talked a lot about the fundamentals, things like, do you have a 10-year investment horizon or you probably shouldn't be in the market, establishing a risk tolerance. In fact, you should have an emergency fund before you invest. You know, so when you finally get to the market, you can be confident and you've done your homework. And then you get to the point where you finally have to build a portfolio. We have to, you know.
And just a quick nutshell definition of build a portfolio.
Well, you want it to be, this is going to be a group of investments. And it could be one account or many accounts or several accounts. But you're going to want to make sure that you have some stock exposure. And we talked about stocks before, and some bonds or cash, and that together, this collection of securities is the key to higher performance. Actually, the mix of your investments will give you a higher return than the actual investments you pick, which is most people don't understand that. But the professional investors do. That's why they spend so much time asking about your risk tolerance and this and that, because it's the allocation that's really important. But something I want to get into first is that why stocks at all? Because I get that a lot, especially with people who are have been through large drops in stocks like the end of the 2000 and 1987, and of course the Great Recession in 2008. And the reason why stocks is because stocks offer something that no other publicly offered investment does. I mean, there are private things like private equity firms and things. But what it offers that a CD doesn't or other cash insurance is it lets you tap the innovation.
Innovation.
That's the key. That out there are, as everyone knows, there are ideas all the time and inventions. And by becoming a shareholder of this company, you're allowed to tie into their business plan. Whatever that successful business plan, business model is, you participate. And this innovation is the things that have built, of course, the great companies and all that stuff. So when you buy a bond, they say you're going to get a certain interest rate and you get your money back. That's it. It's a contract. If you buy an annuity, it's the same, a fixed annuity is the same thing. If you're in a bank account.
So you get your $100 back plus some interest for letting them borrow it.
And CDs are the same.
Right.
And what they do is offer very valuable service because they're in turn investing in things that are somewhat volatile and they're giving you a contract saying you won't experience that volatility, you are guaranteed X. But that guarantee comes at the cost of not being able to have that innovation. So stocks offer something if you're looking for long-term, you know, growth. Stocks offer something that is incredibly valuable, which is, so when I explain it that way to clients, they get it. And the way you do that really over time is just to diversify. You have to spread out. The average person shouldn't have a concentrated portfolio, without a lot of research, because every time you have fewer securities, of course, you have something goes wrong, it affects a larger portion of your portfolio. So diversification is the key.
And when you say that, yeah, you're kind of also saying instead of just having one stock like Google and putting all your money into it, yeah, you have 10 different stocks.
Yes.
So that you're spreading out the risk of one stock going belly up.
10 or 100, or I mean, if you invest in a mutual fund, it's maybe 200 stocks. I mean, they're or an index fund, especially. And for the average person, those kind of things can be a good way to go. And picking up on your 10 stocks, it's not just different companies, you know, your favorite companies or something, but it's also industries you want and sectors. You want to have, you know, something in whatever it would be, you know, pharmaceuticals and high tech and
financials or
our clients would be no oil, you know. So you have different
and then making sure you're not
different things.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I like to diversify even farther. It's a little off topic, but I like to diversify across financial industries. I think it's important clients have some money in the bank and the stock market and insurance companies because they're all regulated differently by different government organizations and they all have different pots of money as insurance against failure. So I think it's important to diversify even that much, real diversification, but that's an aside.
Okay.
For the moment, just to throw that out there. So when you build a portfolio, you're talking about diversification. In the industry, this is called asset allocation.
Asset allocation,
yeah.
Right.
And so the big thing that when you deal with yourself or you deal with an advisor is we have to decide, well, based on your risk tolerance, you know, what and your time horizon, how long do you have to invest, and can you replace the money and all the things we talked about in the first segment. Right. Is it how we build this thing? How much is going to be in stocks? How much is going to be in bonds or fixed income or cash or something like that? And that ratio is determined by those things. So you want to set, you know, where is your comfort level? Young person could be as much, well, could be 100%, but it could be 90%, 80% is in stocks because they have this huge time horizon we talked about. And they have a way they can replace any things that go down, they can just afford to wait for it to come back. For older folks where you can't replace the money, of course, you know, you want to be more conservative. So this is the value, and that allocation changes over time.
And when you say conservative, you mean switching them into bonds.
Thanks. Yeah, that's right. Switching to more fixed income, we call it, because it's cash or bonds or.
Right, and so older I get, the more bonds I have.
The older you get,
the younger I am, more stocks I have.
But of course, there's an exception. And that is that we get this all the time because some clients will say, well, I've got a bunch of money and I've covered myself with fixed income. I just have it over here or I have some other. The portfolio that we're investing with you, we just want it all in stocks. You know, we know already that this is part of our allocation. And we've got that. We want it just to be stocks and we want it to be just socially responsible and we want to be very aggressive. Because it's kind of interesting, and these are the things you learn over time as a professional. There's asset allocation, then there's goals per the account. So this account that they're investing very aggressively, they're saying, well, you know, really, we have enough money to retire on.
So they're safe. They're always safe.
They're safe over here with their allocation, right. And they're also got enough money to retire on. This money is going to be for our kids. So we are actually going to use the time horizon of their life. They're only like 25 or 30.
Right.
So Todd, we want you to invest this as if it was a 30-year-old because it's eventually going to go to the kids.
So they're the old people are protected because they got their bonds set up. They're setting up, they're trying to send some money into the future for the kids. And the best way to do that is to go through stocks and be aggressive. Can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
Just a quick question.
You can ask me.
Could I achieve financial independence and safety and all that by just sticking with bonds when I was in my 20s?
Ooh. I'm going to say no.
Right. It'll never
I'll say no. Because you can't, well, first you'd be losing this proven power of innovation.
Right, because you're losing that cash innovation thing.
And it won't keep up with inflation. That's the issue. I mean, the deal here is, you know, they're giving you that percentage rate, but it's they're also can't be too high because they can't make any profit.
Right, so if they're giving you 3% and the inflation rate's 2%, you're only earning 1%. Whereas if you had a great stock or a great basket of stocks, there's no telling what the percentage return might be over 40, 50 years.
Well, that's a good way to put it, legally.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. There's no telling.
Got it, okay.
Because we can't promise, but It's you're harnessing the human need to innovate.
Right,
the
you're human harnessing America need, in a way.
Well, the world. I mean, the people and China now and every, you know.
Right,
and
right,
so it's
right.
They want to create something new. And there's so many. There's people out there who just have to drive. They're type A plus.
Right.
And or committees or groups. I mean, there's also, you know, teams of people, but they have to go. They have to. And now, of course, we're, I don't know, bias is the right word, but we're heavily influenced by climate change because we are believe in it, and our clients believe in it. Now you see these huge innovations to try and deal with the climate problem, and I think will be found. You just find. I just talked to someone last night and say they found a battery that's four times better than Tesla.
And I hate to say this, but what we're also saying is that because of climate change, a lot of people are going to get rich.
Well,
I didn't say
you know,
that.
But it is funny. It's, you know, I think that's exactly what you're going to see. Something else that's really important as you make this portfolio is the power of automatic investing. So. That is something that people
definition of
is that when you ask your employer to take so much money out of your account and your earnings and put it into your 401k, or you ask if you're not talking about 401k and just yourself, you can ask your bank to just automatically send so much money out of your savings account, checking account, into your investment firm.
Right.
And what happens with that is you sort of set and forget to a certain extent, not what you're investing in, but that. It's amazing. Once this people go, well, I don't really know if we can afford that. Once you do that, people never miss the money. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I experienced that.
Yeah, you know, you're making X, and you now X minus whatever, and you just live on X minus whatever, and you just and but meanwhile, you're growing with America as America innovates. You're part of the whole thing, but that's a very important thing. It's part of this whole plan, this whole strategy, is to try and make sure it just becomes regular. And of course, for the IRAs and everything else, we talked about earlier that one on the first show that you should make sure that you should invest in your IRS qualified plans first, IRAs, company plan, because there you get tax advantages and you might get an employer match.
Right, don't leave the free money on the table.
Don't free money, that's
get
right.
Get free money
Thank
first.
You. That's right.
Right.
One of the greatest assets that you have, and this seems trite, but for young people it's so important to stress on them, is time. Because older people, they have time, you know, I mean, young people feel, gosh, you guys have all the money because we're older. But really, they've got something we don't have, and that's time to compound, to make sure that they, investments, even a little bit at a time, started when you're in your 20s or whatever, or started for, by the way, just an aside, for a young person who has worked and has earned income in their teens, you can start opening a Roth IRA for them if you want. Yes.
Just quickly, yep. Teens, how can a 16-year-old start a Roth?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought children weren't allowed to.
No. Nope.
Right.
They have earned income. They have to have earned income.
And the good news is when they apply to college, the Roth can't be touched.
Ooh, I don't know.
I'm just thinking of my son.
I don't think so. Ooh, I should. We don't do much college planning because those are 529 plans.
But there's a question.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Because the Roth is really important.
Because it can be pulled out tax without any penalty, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Okay, we'll leave it at that.
But even so, again, yeah, but you're dealing this for the child's future. I mean, if they start a Roth IRA when they're 16 or 17, I mean, this thing is going to be. I mean, Albert Einstein said that compounding was the eighth wonder of the world. It didn't seem to be something he'd talk about somewhere along the line, but I verified it. And it's interesting, as an aside, I guess we had talked about this a little bit. Even if you, IRAs, as you know, you contribute every year, or you can contribute every year, and you can start contributing in the year of the contribution, but you actually have until April the next year to finish it up. Everyone
knows
that.
How long is that?
Oh, well, it'd be, oh gosh, that's 16 months?
So 16
Something like that.
So it's longer than a year.
Yeah, it's longer than a year that the government tries to make it easy, you know.
Yeah.
If you contribute in January of the year you can contribute, let's say in a 2019 contribution, right?
Okay.
So if you contribute this January, last January, versus waiting till 2020 April, if you just kept doing that every year instead of waiting till April, you would make thousands of dollars more by the time you retire.
So instead of waiting till it's almost too late to do it,
yeah.
If I just started on the first day I could do it,
yeah.
I'm winding up with a lot more money in a lifetime. Yeah,
you just, and you think it wouldn't make that much difference because it just sort of goes off to the end and you're doing it anyway. Right. But no, it's just, and so time is critical. Time is really, really important.
So even these little packets of time can equal a lot of money.
Yeah. And lastly, a couple of things, which is, and I have developed ways to sort of explain this to clients that I think is easier to take, is staying the course. Yeah, everyone say, you know, you got your plan, you put your portfolio together, right. You know, now, don't get totally spooked by the market. Don't give up. Don't stop contributing. And that's one thing that a professional can help with. But one line I develop with clients is they'll be going, oh my God, this is happening in the trade wars. And I say, yes, but good news can break out at any time.
If you're sitting on the sidelines saying, I'm going to wait until it's all good.
Yeah.
You could be a week too late, and that could be a lot of the earnings potential. That 1 week, that little packet of time might have made you a lot of money if you had been in the market waiting for it, out of the market hiding from it.
That's right. I think they're like, there's over time, there's various amount of days that they talk about, but they talk 26 days that you, if you
or
were not,
that number.
Were,
yeah, I've
you were
that.
Not, yeah, if right. you're not in the market, you would have lost X. You still would have done well, but if you were just there during those recoveries, you know, for example, the whole period of 2009 through 2000 now, one of the best things, most important things a financial advisor does, because they're always saying, do financial advisors beat the market? Do they really beat the index funds? Well, yes and no, but the most important thing they do very often is they keep people in the market. That when they do it themselves,
they walk them back.
Yeah, no, they just say, look, yeah, don't do it now. Let's see, let's only take some out. I think things will look a little better, you know.
Because right. at the end of the day, when the stuff is hitting the fan, for most people, the only person they have to turn to is their wife or their children or their friends, and they could all be panicking as well.
Very, that's great. Right? That's great. Yeah, that's exactly right.
One voice of reason saying, want to chill?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right, so the last thing you know, these things to do with your portfolio and things to build the building blocks of an investment plan is, you know, for our clients. So there's some, or for people who are very involved in making sure their investments align with their values. So obviously that's a cardinal thing for them, right. Not everyone. And we'll get into that. We have a segment on that in the end. But I didn't want to make it all about social responsible investing. I wanted to get these basics
yes,
in.
I got you.
But for people who obviously, you know, are very concerned with the planet and helping others, using their investments, that's a big building block too.
Okay. All right. So in the next segment we're going to do, what are we doing in the next segment? Your top 10 or what was that we're talking about?
Yeah, something like that. I haven't had done that much this specific, and I was just a little concerned that some people are watching this going, I know already, this is pretty basic stuff. Yeah. But I'm amazed when I deal with clients who are fairly sophisticated, is they haven't really thought through some things.
Right. Well, quite frankly, there's also so much to remember at any given moment, and your brain's only pulling up three things when there actually is probably 22.
Right. Right. That's right. So this next segment is some little tips that that are more specific about investing. You know.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll see you next time. Thanks so much for watching.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.